Welcome to the Hyphen Church Podcast, where faith meets the spaces in between. We're here to explore what it means to belong, to grow, and to encounter God in the midst of life's questions and complexities. Whether you're here to listen, reflect, or take a step forward, know that you're in the right place. Let's make space together for what God is doing in us and through us. Now, let's dive into today's message.
So this is Palm Sunday, the traditional day where Christ enters into the city of Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. And we tend to, in the church, talk about the triumph of the entry and then the triumph of the grave. And we skip over all that Good Friday stuff, and especially if we don't have a Good Friday service to go to. And so what I usually like to do on Palm Sunday is preach Good Friday, preach the crucifixion, preach that part of the story so that when we go to Easter, when we know that, we will be in a great spot to understand the triumph of the grave, that this doesn't come out of nowhere, that the context there is important. And we've been marching through the wilderness, and Jesus was on this wilderness journey as well, being led into the wilderness by the Spirit and being tempted there for 40 days. And all of this is to prepare him for this moment on the cross. All of that is culminating in this experience of you have to go through these things in order to do what we're doing here. Desperation, deprivation, dryness, despair. All of these things leading up to that moment on the cross. And so we've been working through this series, Into the Wilderness, to do that same thing in our own lives. Where is God in my desperation? Where is God in my despair? What work is being done in those moments to understand these places, to understand why, in time and time again, the Bible says God led him into the wilderness. And we have this final moment in the wilderness. We have this final picture of what it means to be wilderness people. And we're going to read this morning in Matthew 27. And this is the traditional Good Friday reading in the year that we're in. The reading of Matthew 27, the picture of Christ on the cross. Some years we look at the trial, some years we look at the execution, and we're going to read this morning about his death. Starting at verse 45. From noon on, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. And at about 3:00, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani," which is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And when some of the bystanders heard it, they said, "This man is calling for Elijah." And at once one of them ran and got a sponge and filled it with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink. But others said, "Wait, let's see whether Elijah will come to save him." Then Jesus cried again and with a loud voice and breathed his last. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, and the rocks were split, and the tombs also were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. After his resurrection, they came out of the tombs and entered the holy city and appeared to many. Now, when the centurion and those with him who were keeping watch over Jesus saw the earthquake and what took place, they were terrified and said, "Truly, this man was God's son." Will you pray with me? God, as we have heard these words, if we have seen what your son has done, let them enter our hearts. Guide us in our darkness. Guide us in these moments. And illuminate in our hearts what it is you want from us. All glory to your son, our king, whose name we pray. Amen. Did you know that we are not born afraid of the dark? That's a skill we learn. That's something that we pick up later on in life. If you put a six-month-old baby in a dark room, it will not worry. It will not cry out. The darkness is not the thing that scares him. There's no panic. It's just another environment. And you have to think, growing up in the womb for 9 months, that is a dark chamber. And coming out of that, there is more darkness. Babies thrive in a dark situation, but somewhere along the way, we learn to be afraid of the dark. And we have to have, Sadie has a nightlight, and she's got this little star thing that casts stars on the ceiling. And then she's got another little colored nightlight that flashes and goes. She wants to fill the room with light so she can see. And somewhere along the way, that was something that she learned to do. Darkness takes away our primary way of knowing the world through our sight. We know the world and it takes away that sense. And when we can't see, we start to imagine what might be there. But here's the thing. There's nothing in the dark that isn't there in the daylight also. The room doesn't change when the sun goes down. What changes is our ability to perceive it. And that changes everything about how we trust. In the daylight, we trust because we can see the room. We can see the things around us. But in the darkness, we have to trust who we know. And today we're at the cross. And from noon until 3 p.m, the brightest part of the day, darkness covers the land. There's not a storm. There's not an eclipse. There's just darkness. And in that darkness, three things happen. The world goes dark, and we don't understand what God is doing. And God feels absence, and we don't feel what we believe to be true about God. And I believe that that darkness reveals God, and we can finally see what was there all along. This is the sixth and final week of Lent, the final Sunday in Lent, and we've walked through the wilderness, we've stared at dry bones, we've learned to stop fleeing and pursuing, and now we are standing at the place in the wilderness. We have to get through this dark night. And in this darkness, God doesn't just meet us. He enters it. He fully enters it, and he transforms what darkness means forever. Darkness, it comes at noon. It's the brightest part of the day. And the Bible points this out. Matthew makes it a specific point to write this. And he would have written it as the sixth hour to the ninth hour because of the way that they told time. But the sun stops shining and we're not told what's happening. And some might say that this is an eclipse that's going on, but we know it's not an eclipse. We know it's not because Passover happens during a full moon and an eclipse can only happen during a new moon. So it's astronomically impossible to be an eclipse. This isn't a storm. We're not describing the rain and the wind and the thunder. This is darkness. This is a phenomenon that can only happen through supernatural abilities. This is cosmic darkness. This is a darkness that should not exist in this moment. The sun, which has never failed to rise since Genesis 1, refuses to shine on the crucifixion of its creator. And here's something that we might miss because we're not plugged into that idea anymore. But it lasts for 3 hours, and this is the exact duration of the afternoon sacrifice at the temple. Okay, so now our ears perk up a little bit, right? Because we know as we're reading this, as Matthew is pointing this out, there is something going on here that is different. There's something going on here that God is trying to focus on, that he's trying to get us to point to. God is making a statement, but the people standing there, they just don't get it. They're not clued into it. And we're not clued into it. And God is like, I don't know how I can make this any clearer to you. It's going to go dark. It's going to be 3 hours long. What more do you want? How many more signs can I give you? Jesus then cries out in this loud voice, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani, which is Aramaic, his home tongue, his mother tongue, the language that he grew up in the house speaking. This is an intimacy. My God, why have you forsaken me? And the people there misunderstand. They think he's calling out for Elijah. They're standing at the crucifixion of the Messiah, the hinge point of all of human history. And they think he's calling for a prophet to rescue him. Huh. It sounds like Elijah. It's similar. The language is similar, but it's more than that. It's confusion. It's blindness. It's darkness covering their ears and their hearts and their minds to not accept the reality of what's happening. And everything about this moment is incomprehensible to them. There is a physical darkness that's over the land, but there is an actual spiritual darkness that's happening as the people are standing there. A man who claimed to be the Son of God is dying like a criminal. The sun has stopped shining in the middle of the day. And they're standing in the dark, offering him sour wine, waiting to see if Elijah shows up. And they don't understand what God is doing. Because what God is doing doesn't look like what they expect. This is what darkness does. We don't understand what's happening in the darkness. We don't understand what God is doing in these moments. And in those wilderness moments, as the sun sets on a day, we have to camp out there. And yeah, when we're in the safety of our homes, we know we can tell our children the room hasn't changed. There's nothing there. But imagine being in the wilderness when you're falling asleep in your tent and darkness shows up. There are new creatures. There are new threats. There are things that weren't there in the darkness. And what does that cause us to do? Focus. Change our perception around us. Well, I can't see the world around me with my sight, so I need to use something else for perception. And so we start to say, we don't know what God is doing, and it's not because we're stupid. It's not because we're unfaithful. Because God's deepest work often looks like the opposite of what we expect it to look like. Victory looks like defeat. Power looks like weakness. The Son of God looks like a dying criminal. And when we can't make sense of it, we do what the crowd does. We offer sour wine. We misinterpret the cries. We wait for a rescue that's not coming because we're looking for the wrong thing. Now, when my children were born, I sat in the waiting room waiting. Miranda went back and had her C-sections, and she had all that stuff go on. And I could not see the surgery. There wasn't like a little video camera there. I didn't really want to see the surgery. But I couldn't see what was happening. I couldn't hear the surgeon's voice. I couldn't watch the monitors. All I could see was the clock. And that was it. And in that waiting, I had no idea how things were going. The surgery could have been a disaster. There could have been complications with the baby. All I knew in that moment was I had to wait. I was blind to what was going on around me. And this is the curtain that God has shown. Behind that curtain, there is something going on that we just cannot see, that we cannot be necessarily invited into. The removing of sin, the tearing down of the barrier, the opening of the graves, we just can't see it yet. But we know that God is there working in those things. We know that God is doing that work behind the scenes. Now, if you ever watch a caterpillar enter a cocoon, you would assume that it's going to die, right? You don't know what's happening inside. And in fact, for a very, very long time, scientists who study butterflies, they did not even understand what was happening in that cocoon. The idea of going through a metamorphosis, the idea of the body of the caterpillar just turning into goo and then becoming a butterfly was so foreign. But inside that cocoon, the body breaks down completely. It dissolves and it reforms into something completely new. And from the outside, we don't get to view that. We don't get to see inside what's going on. That's what we're dealing with here. Inside that darkness, God is transforming death into life, sin into forgiveness, the grave into the doorway. We can't see it, but we know that it's happening. Because transformation requires darkness. And we don't understand that until we've walked through it. In week 4, Elijah fled from despair into the cave. And God asked him, "What are you doing here?" And last week, Ezekiel stood in the valley of dry bones. And God asked him, "Can these bones live?" And now at the cross, the question is, can you trust me when you can't see or understand what I'm doing? The wilderness has been training us for this moment. We've learned to stop fleeing and start pursuing. We've learned to call for breath we can't control. And now we're learning the deepest lesson that to trust in the darkness what we knew in the light. Even when the world goes dark, even when we don't understand what God is doing. And so what has gone dark in your world? What is that darkness moment for you? And what if God is doing something you just can't see yet? What if God feels absent, not because he is absent, but because that primary way that you know him has gone dark? How can we know God better? How can we know God in more than one way to trust that when he feels absent, he is there again? One of the big questions about this text, though, is God truly forsaken? A lot of theological print has been spilled on this idea. Did God abandon his son? And if God abandoned his son, if God turned his back on his son, does he do that for us as well? There is this deep agony. Jesus doesn't reach for formality. He reaches for intimacy. Is the Trinity fractured? Is the bond broken? Or is Jesus just entering into the human experience of feeling forsaken? Taking on the full weight of what it feels like to be cut off from God without actually being abandoned. And the text, it doesn't resolve this. It doesn't really tell us one way or another. But here's what we know. Jesus feels forsaken. He's not pretending. He's not performing. The cry is real. And whether the forsakenness is actual or it's experiential, the result is the same, that Jesus knows what it's like to cry out to a God who feels absent. Jesus embodies that same spirit that we feel, that same moment of darkness, the deep night of the soul, where we say, just God is not here. He knows what it's like to be in the dark and not feel the presence you've always known. And he knows what it's like when you believe what you believe is true doesn't match what you feel. He knows what that feels like. and he doesn't resolve the tension, he prays it. He cries out, "My God, my God." He knows and he believes that God is still there. "Why have you forsaken me?" And he just sits there with that lament. "I still believe you're there, but I don't feel you." And this is where most of us live most of the time. We believe God is present, but we don't feel it. We believe God is working, but we can't see it. We believe God loves us, but we feel alone. And the cross doesn't remove that tension from our lives. The cross doesn't wrap it up in a nice little bow. You know what the cross does with that tension? It validates it. It doubles down on it. And it says, yeah, you do feel like this. You will feel like this from time to time. This is going to happen to you. It happened to Jesus. So why do you think you are immune to that? Because if Jesus, the Son of God, fully divine, perfectly faithful, can cry out and feel, "Why have you forsaken me?" in his darkest moment, then we will too. Or we should, at least. And this isn't a lament that means a failure of faith. It is an expression of faith. Jesus hasn't lost his faith by crying out, "Why have you forsaken me?" This is an expression of where his faith is. He says, he's not saying, "God, I don't believe you anymore." He's saying, "I just don't feel you. I know you're supposed to be here, but where are you?" Belief and lament, trust and anguish, held together in the same breath. And when God feels absent, we don't have to pretend he feels present. We don't have to fake it till we make it. We can be honest with God. And in fact, I think, I could be wrong, but I think that's what we're meant to do. I think we're meant to stand in the shadow of the cross and be honest with our Creator about how we feel. We can name the absence. We can cry out. We can ask why. And that is not doubt. It's faith. A lot of times we'll go to God in prayer and we'll say, "Oh yeah, everything's just hunky-dory. I'm feeling really good today. Feeling really, really peppy." Why can't we be honest with our God? Because I'm going to tell you that faith isn't pretending that everything is fine. Faith is clinging to God even when he feels absent. That's what faith is. And Jesus models this for us. He feels forsaken and he still calls God, "My God." And that's what trust looks like in the dark. My kids still wake up in the middle of the night. And you know what they want in the middle of the night when it's dark? They want mom or dad. We can go and sit with them, we can go and lay with them, but you know, we don't turn on the light, we don't search under the bed, we just say, "I'm here, everything's gonna be okay." And we might hold hands, or we might cuddle up, or we might get closer, but we have to get through the night. And they can fall asleep and they can relax and they can know better, not because the darkness went away, but because they knew they weren't alone in it. And that's what Jesus is doing on the cross. He's sitting in the dark with us saying, "I know what this feels like. I've been here. I've cried out and I've felt nothing in return." And he doesn't get to turn the lights on. He doesn't remove the darkness. And that's the same thing that happens with us. We don't always get to cry out to God and say, "Remove the darkness from here. Turn on the lights. Let's sweep the room." We don't get to do that. We don't have the power to do that. But what we do have the power to do is call on God and say, "Where are you now? I want to feel your presence. He enters into the darkness. And in doing so, he proves that we are not alone. God feels absent, but he is not. And the proof is Jesus calling out in the dark. Now, notice what happens after Jesus cries out. The crowd misunderstands. They offer sour wine. They wait to see if Elijah comes. But there is no answer from heaven. There's no voice from the Father. There's no reassurance. There's just silence. God doesn't answer, not because he's not there, but because the answer's coming in 3 days. And I think we would do really well to remember that when we are sitting there in the silence, when we're trying to go about this, when we're trying to get through this, when we're trying to solve the darkness that we're sitting in, and we accept sour wine as the solution, boy, oh boy, just wait 3 days. God is doing something new. If only we can wait for it. Sometimes God's silence isn't that absence, but it's the space between the question and the resurrection. We read Psalm 22, "My God, my God." And every Jewish person standing there would know the rest of the psalm, though. It starts with lament. It starts with abandonment. It starts with desperation, but it ends with praise, with deliverance, with victory. Verse 24 says, "For he has not despised or scorned the suffering of the afflicted one. He has not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help." Jesus is praying the whole psalm, not just the lament, but the hope too. He's saying, "I feel forsaken, but I know you are listening." And that's the pattern of faith, the cry out in the dark and trust that God hears you even when you can't feel him. What would it mean for you to cry out in the middle of your pain? What would it mean for you to cry out in the middle of the darkness? What would it mean for you to sit in the darkness and not try and remove it? Not try and control whether the lights are on, when the lights come up, but to sit and know that you're not alone. Verse 54 is the way this passage ends. "And when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, 'Surely he was the Son of God.'" Why does a Roman centurion, the Gentile executioner, see what everyone else misses? Jesus dies with this declaration. See, most crucifixion victims die slowly and weakly and silently. It's asphyxiation that steals their breath. They don't bleed out, they actually just, they choke. But Jesus dies shouting, by the way. Matthew doesn't tell us what he shouts. John does. But he emphasizes the volume of that. "And in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit." This isn't defeat, right? This is victory. This is what it looks like to be victorious. Jesus doesn't have death taken from him. He releases it. He gives up his spirit, by the way. Not his spirit was taken from him. Even in death, he is in control. And the moment he dies, everything responds. The curtain is torn. This, by the way, is a curtain that is 60 feet high and 30 feet wide and 4 inches thick. And it rips apart. And for centuries, that curtain would stand and say, "You stay on that side, God's going to stay on this side, and only the priests can enter this Holy of Holies." And Jesus says, "Nope, That's done with. You want access to God? You got it. Jesus opens that door. God tears that up in half and he changes the relationship. And then creation responds. The earth shook, the rocks split, the tombs broke open. This isn't just death. This is a cosmic event. This is the world around Jesus responding to that. And all of this still happens in the darkness. I would be frightened, wouldn't you? And then a Roman soldier speaks, not a disciple, not a religious leader, not someone who's there to hold the crowd back, to calm them down, not someone who's been following Jesus for his ministry. The executioner, the man who has come to kill Jesus. This is the first full confession of Jesus' divinity in Matthew. And it comes from the least likely person in the darkest moment of the day. Why? Because he was paying attention, wasn't he? He saw the darkness, he felt the earthquake, he watched the way Jesus died, and he knew that this wasn't a criminal. This was the Son of God. And sometimes I think that there are some things that can only be seen, can only be felt in the darkness. Because the light obscures them. We get so used to the way something looks or feels. We get into that routine and we say, yeah, I can see it and I can trust it. And we need the lights off, even if just for a moment, to say, this is disorienting. But what is it that you want me to see, God? Darkness strips away the distraction. It removes the noise. It forces focus. And when you're forced to focus, you see what was there all along. That centurion didn't need resurrection to believe. He saw the truth in darkness. And that's the pattern. God reveals himself most clearly, not in the light, but in the dark, to the people who are paying attention. I think the night sky is a wonderful thing. You get out on those summer nights or even in the winter nights when it's perfectly clear and still and you look up and you realize how small we are. The night sky opens up that and you can see galaxies and you can see stars and you can see planets that we'll never know, we'll never visit. But the amazing fact about that is they don't go away in the daytime. It's just that the sun obscures them. It's too bright to see the stars at night. They're still there. You can go and look up, and if you're really, really, really good, you might be able to find maybe the brightest one. The night sky is just obscured. It's just that the sun's light overwhelms them. You can't perceive them. It's only in the darkness that you see what was there all along. And the darker the sky, the more you can see. Light pollution washes out the stars, but in true darkness, the sky explodes with details. Details that are always there. We just can't perceive them. And that's what happens at the cross. The darkness doesn't hide who Jesus is, it reveals him. The centurion sees in the darkness what the crowd missed in the daylight. All through Scripture, the pattern is the same. Moses meets God in the darkness of Sinai. Elijah hears God in the whisper of the cave. Job encounters God in the whirlwind. And the centurion sees Jesus as the Son of God in the darkness of the cross. Not after the darkness lifts, but during. Because God's greatest revelation comes in the darkest moments to people who are paying attention. What might the darkness you're in be revealing about God that you couldn't see in the light? I think there's three ways that we can embody this, three things that we can do or not do that says, I understand the darkness. I understand what is required of me here in this moment. The first one is stop offering sour wine and stop taking it. They're trying to do something in the crowd. They're trying to do something because they don't know what else to do. And sometimes when we don't know what to do, the best course of action is just to sit there and wait. And to be a son or to be a daughter of your Creator. And it's going to hurt. It's going to be troublesome to try and let our hands go, to get things out of our control, to say, you know what? No, I'm not going to control this. I'm not going to see what it is. But I know God is. The second thing is to pray the lament without resolving it. God, my God, why have you forsaken me? And stop. Let that be your prayer in the moment. Don't try and soften it. Don't try and resolve it. Don't try and take the next step. Don't try and guess what God is going to do. But sit with that lament. Sit with that despair and heartache. Don't say, I know you're there. I trust you anyway. Just pray the lament. Let it be raw. Let it be honest. Let God handle your cry. And the third thing is we need to let our eyes adjust to the dark. We need to learn to be people that can not see in the darkness, but perceive better. Our eyes will adjust. We will get better and better at seeing things in the dark if we just give it time. And we can say, God, help me see what the darkness is revealing that the light has obscured. Pay attention to what is happening around you and find a new way to perceive the world. Don't just rely on your eyes. Don't rely on the things you can see, but rely on the things you can touch and hear and smell. I know that God lives through those things. All of this requires one thing. It's trust. Trust when you don't understand. Trust when you can't feel. Trust when you can't yet see. The cross is an abandonment. It's a declaration that darkness is going to come. And we need to sit with it. And we need to know that God will seek us in it.